As the new Pritzker administration takes office, we're speaking to different stakeholders about their hopes for the next 4 years. Today, businesses.
As your governor, I will be committed to helping us become the fastest growing big state economy in the nation. I'll be our state's best chief marketing officer to attract jobs and businesses to Illinois.
Plus, we hear from filmmakers involved in a new series called Real Midwest, including Alan Parsa, who captured his great-grandfather's journey from Columbia to Chicago.
For a lot of Americans, immigration, it's kind of this detached thing. And so to be able to actually put hands on something that he wrote, you know, this ink on the page, it kind of made me connect with that in a way that was new and fresh.
That and more coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, some scientists at Northwestern University are getting us closer to greater understanding of black holes through some recent discoveries. And we're going to hear about a new project that's highlighting films made and set in the Midwest. But first, as of Monday, Illinois has a new state government, from the governor's mansion to the state house in Springfield. And all of this week, as well as next week, we're taking a look at different sectors of our state and talking to folks about what they are hoping for the next 4 years. Yesterday, we spoke with two statewide social service providers, Children's Home and Aid and the Illinois Behavioral Health Association. Today, we're turning to business and to two groups that represent some of our biggest economic sectors. That's manufacturing and retailing. Mark Densler is the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Rob Carr is his counterpart at the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, where he's president and CEO. Both of them are on the line with me now. Hi, Mark. Hi, Rob. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having us.
Rob, before we get into your hopes for the next 4 years, let's talk about the past 4 years. What do you think Governor Rauner did right for Illinois retailers?
They did shepherd and help shepherd through an agreed bill process for unemployment insurance, which I think was a good thing in terms of the changes that it brought for both actually labor and for employers. So I think that is a good thing that came out of that. I think to a certain extent also improved communication between some agencies and those who interact with those agencies. So I think those are a couple of good things that came out of that.
Mark, what about for manufacturers? I think we often felt or heard that Governor Rauner was seen as friendly to the business sector. I wonder if you felt that way for manufacturers across Illinois?
You know, the governor certainly put a spotlight on manufacturing and workforce development, which is one of the major challenges facing the sector. You point out appropriately, I mean, manufacturers employ about 580,000 workers and contribute the single largest share of the gross state product. And so manufacturing is critical to the state. We didn't have a lot of successes. The governor was stymied on a couple things, but he certainly focused the attention on some of the core things that needed to be talked about: workforce development, workers' compensation, regulatory reform. And again, we didn't get a lot of major victories, but certainly focusing the attention on the manufacturing sector and the good high-paying jobs that they provide was important.
That said, Rob, Mark, let's start with you. As we think about the next 4 years, what do you see as the biggest issues, the biggest needs for Illinois manufacturers?
We really haven't had great leadership, executive leadership for the past decade or so. It's really been a struggle. And so I think the business community and the manufacturing sector, first, they want some stability and predictability. We face, obviously, a huge pension debt, and there's a lot of challenges. But, you know, we're optimistic that the governor has talked about the workforce issue. He issued an executive order yesterday. About 300,000 manufacturing workers are going to retire in the next decade. And so we really have to fill that pipeline of workers, of young men and women coming out of high school, returning veterans. So the governor, Pritzker, has made that a priority, and also an infrastructure bill. We haven't had one for a number of years. And so rebuilding our roads and bridges and air and waterways are critically important to the manufacturing sector. 93% of Illinois exports are manufactured products.
Let's start with the whole notion of stability as we as I piece out a couple of the things that you said there, Mark. And then, Rob, I want to get to you in a second as well.
Sure.
Let's just start with the whole idea of creating more stability in Illinois. Is it your hope that the next 4 years we will have more stability than we've had? I'm thinking in particular of the past two. And how important is that for manufacturers in particular when it comes to folks who are bringing their business here?
You know, any business or family, for that matter, they want stability and predictability. The businesses today are making decisions. They're looking 5 or 10 or maybe 20 years down the road. And, you know, the fact that we didn't have a state budget for 2 years and the threat of taxes or new regulations looming, you know, when companies are making decisions about what to locate their capital and put their employees, these all come into account. And a perfect example, Nyla, is the Illinois Research and Development Tax Credit. R&D is the lifeblood of a manufacturer. They're building and innovating products every day. And the R&D credit has turned on and off 5 times in about the last 15 or 16 years. And so companies who are looking to do research and development in the state of Illinois, unfortunately, some have moved their R&D facilities outside. And so, again, we may have some higher costs on certain things like work comp, but they just need to know that we're stable. They need to know how they can plan when they're going to put their equipment or capital in Illinois.
Mark, have you been able to communicate that to the Pritzker administration? Do you think that message is getting out there? I wanted to note one thing that Governor Pritzker said in his inauguration address, that he feels like he's the chief marketing officer for the state, and he feels like he's the chief cheerleader, and that's something he's going to always keep in mind when he's speaking about Illinois.
You know, that's a great point. We've had a number of conversations with his staff, and I know they're still being named. But now the point is, Illinois should be an economic engine. When you look at all the assets that we have, we have a central location, we have a skilled workforce, we have an excellent infrastructure, more miles of highway, we have a world-class city, a global airport. We have everything in Illinois that should lead us to be an economic engine, not only of the Midwest, but the nation. And so having a governor that will talk about those advantages and will help sell the state and not tear it down are important, because, you know, reputation is important. And unfortunately, Illinois over the last decade or so has gotten a poor reputation, deserve it or not. And so, again, we have to change the reputation of Illinois. And part of that, it comes from the governor, and part of that comes from changing policies to make it friendlier for job creators.
That's Mark Densler. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. We're also speaking with Rob Carr, who is president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Rob, I wonder how many of these things that Mark has been talking about, workforce development, infrastructure, stability, how important is that also for retailers across the state?
They're very important. I think the fact that, you know, Mark, I'll start where Mark ended. Illinois has a lot of advantages. And we need someone who's going to note those advantages. We also need someone who's going to address the shortcomings. Illinois is losing and has lost a significant amount of population in the recent years. Some would lay that all at the feet of the former governor, but I don't think that's an accurate diagnosis of what Illinois is facing. Retailers see those as lost sales. Those people walking out are walking out with their pocketbooks, and they're not being replaced with people with the same income levels. So it makes it harder for retailers to meet their own costs, let alone the additional costs that are being imposed upon them. So that's important. Stability is important. There needs to be a recognition at all levels of government that they are not operating in a silo, that they operate together, and that businesses, whether it's a retailer or a manufacturer or a wholesaler, pays all of those costs out of one pocket. They're not like government. They don't have different layers, and they don't have different pockets. So hopefully we will see some recognition of that and some restraint in terms of the priorities. We all know that the state has a fiscal problem it has to solve, and that they've got to address that, but then you also can't pile a lot of other costs on that. So that's some of the things that we look at in terms of stability. And then finally, a recognition that retail's mobile. No longer do you have to be on the street in brick and mortar. You can't just abandon it, but you can. A retailer can now sell from anywhere in the world, and that's an important change that's taken place just in the last decade.
I wanted to play just a little bit of a couple of these points we've been talking about from Monday's inauguration speech of Governor Pritzker, speaking specifically about businesses, jobs, the economy. Let's take a listen to that.
Working men and women deserve to have a governor and a Department of Labor that will enforce laws protecting workers' wages and workers' rights. And they deserve a $15 minimum wage. It's good for the working families of Illinois and good for our economy. As your governor, I will be committed to helping us become the fastest growing big state economy in the nation. I'll be our state's best chief marketing officer to attract jobs and businesses to Illinois. We'll bring capital and technical assistance and mentorship to help Illinoisans across our state to start and build new businesses and new jobs.
Governor J.B. Pritzker on Monday in his inauguration address. A couple of things we've already talked about in terms of workforce development, but he also talked about minimum wage. And Rob, I know this is something the Illinois Retail and Merchants Association has not been necessarily in favor of a $15 minimum wage. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, it is a point. You'll recall, Nyla, that we were the only business association that did not endorse Governor Rauner for re-election in this last cycle. But it is a point. This is a point that we have disagreed with now Governor Pritzker, then candidate Pritzker on. To be fair as well, there's nuances to the minimum wage debate as well. So what we're encouraged by is that Governor Pritzker, both as a candidate and now as governor, has talked about bringing everybody together who's willing to engage in positive discussions. And we're looking forward to those discussions with him. And we think there is some room around this issue that we can explore if they are indeed willing to do that. I also think, though, that, it is a recognition to what I said earlier. You can't do everything. There have to be limits to the cost that you're going to impose, not only on consumers, but also on businesses, because businesses have limited capital that they're going to invest any year, and they're going to invest it where they get the best rate of return. And we can have all the positive stories and marketing about Illinois and all of its advantages, but if that rate of return doesn't exceed someone else's, those investments aren't going to be made here. So it's a balancing act, and we look forward to exploring that with the governor and his team.
Both of you, I wanted to ask you what you think of J.B. Pritzker's background. Obviously, as a Democrat, he's got a lot of progressive ideas within his platform, but he's someone who has spent a lot of time in the business world. And I'm thinking of his background in venture capital, in Chicago, in the tech startup scene, and his time there. Mark, I wonder how you're hoping that will translate well for understanding what Illinois manufacturers need.
You know, it's certainly the fact that he's been in innovation and technology and entrepreneurship is important. He has an understanding of business, which is important. You know, he's had to write paychecks and balance a budget. I mean, Rob talked about the importance of the budget, and, you know, you talk about the importance or the discussion of minimum wage. I'd remind folks that $15 an hour, and we need those jobs, equates to about $31,000 a year. The average manufacturing job pays $74,000 in wages and benefits. So, you know, we hope that the governor and lawmakers don't focus solely on $15 an hour wage in those jobs, but really look at manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, healthcare, innovation. But, you know, we're heartened that the governor has a background in business. He understands this. He's put his money where his mouth is on occasion. And again, we look forward to working with him to grow the manufacturing sector. We've added, Nyla, about 20,000 manufacturing jobs since the recession ended in 2009. By comparison, our neighboring states had an average of 68,000. So the Iowas and Indianas are growing much faster than Illinois, despite a smaller population. So we're heartened to have a governor talking about the importance of the business community. And again, we're not going to agree on every issue, but we look forward to having a productive relationship with him.
That said, Mark, I wonder if you can name, we've talked about a lot of different things here, everything from workers' comp to budget to wages, taxes, education, workforce development. What would be, if you have sort of a wish list of your top three priorities for what you would like to see accomplished in Springfield, not just with the Pritzker administration, but with state lawmakers as well?
You know, we have a big list, and there's not one magic bullet. I get asked a lot of times, what's the magic bullet to fix Illinois' economy? You know, number one, we have to have a balanced budget. We have to address the pension issue. That is the looming sword that hangs over the state's head and the head of job creators and families, and part of the reason that we're seeing the out-migration of folks. So we have to address that, number one. Number two for manufacturers really is that education workforce development. 300,000 manufacturing workers are going to retire in the next decade. We need roughly 25 to 30,000 production workers and engineers every year. Nyla, by 2025, Illinois is going to lose 350,000 workers to retirement, not just manufacturing. So the workforce challenge is prevalent, not only in manufacturing, but in nursing, in education, in transportation. So we really have to address that. And then third, I would just kind of lump together, and it's kind of what Rob talked about, those extra costs, the regulatory costs, the pay leave, the minimum wage, the additional mandates that when we talk to our plant managers and plant owners, you know, individually they may not cost a lot, but when suddenly you get 5 or 10 foisted upon them, that's a significant cost. And so really I would kind of argue the regulatory reform and reducing some of those intrinsic costs to make Illinois more competitive.
Rob, what's at the top of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association legislative agenda?
You know, we really don't have a particular agenda at the moment, but, you know, we're working on all sorts of issues, from pharmacy to grocery to restaurant issues, mass merchandise, you name it. You know, we represent the breadth and the depth of the retail industry. So, you know, we need to pay attention to retail theft is a big deal. There's a lot of losses from particularly organized retail crime. We need to try to be a good partner in terms of bringing stability to the state, but also spreading the message that government needs to show restraint, which includes spending restraint, because we really need to end this cycle. Illinois always talks about getting its fiscal house in order, and it's been talking about that for 20 years, and it's never got it done. It needs to get it done, and it's reached a critical point. So that's part of our hopes for this coming session as well.
Rob Carr is president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Mark Densler is his counterpart at the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Gentlemen, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to the movie industry, we often think of the coasts as the epicenters of talent, but a new independent film series hopes to show that's nothing but a myth by highlighting documentaries, features, and short films from Illinois and surrounding states. It's called Real Midwest. That's R-E-E-L. And it premiered on WILL and WTBP in Peoria recently. Kicking off the series is Inquiring Nuns, the first theatrical release by Cartemquin Films. Here's a clip.
We're working a little experiment with film and asking questions and then kind of just talking on the street. Would you like to be a part of it?
Sure, why not?
First question's easy. Are you happy?
Groovy.
That's a bit of Inquiring Nuns, which just launched as part of the new film series called Real Midwest. If you are in the Champaign-Urbana area or in Peoria, you can catch this on WTBP, WILL on Thursday nights. It's going to be on other Midwest public media stations this spring. Moss Bresnahan is the president and CEO of Illinois Public Media, which produces The 21st and is home to WILL radio and TV. And he's one of the people who's bringing Real Midwest to our small screens. He's here with me in our studios in Urbana. Hi, Moss. Welcome to The 21st.
Nyla, thank you.
So Real Midwest launched just recently, and we're going to talk about some of the titles people are going to see. But what was the goal of this series? What did you want to accomplish with this?
Well, I love independent films, and as you mentioned, not all great documentaries come from New York or L.A. The Midwest has a thriving independent film community in Chicago, but really throughout the Midwest. And independent films line up so well with the mission of public broadcasting. The producers are taking creative risks. They're out there presenting diverse points of view, taking on complex subjects that you don't see always in the mainstream media. And these are films that really deserve to be seen. And so I think it's part of public broadcasting's mission to bring them to our audience.
So let's play a couple clips of them. And let's start with Shine Man, which is one of the films that is included in this Real Midwest series. Let's hear a clip of it.
There's always a connection that happens between that human being working on your shoes and that human being needing that shine. There's an unspoken kind of a character that happens there. There's something that does occur, and whether that person, you know, says, hey, thank you very much, or leaves a big tip or whatever, and I know their life's not changed, but there is a human connection that happens, a very intimate connection that happens between a man shining your shoes and you sitting there having your shoes shined.
A Shine Man, part of the Real Midwest film series that we're talking about now with Moss Bresnahan, who's the president and CEO of Illinois Public Media. Moss, I wonder, that film, others, how did you pick these?
Well, we had dozens of submissions. That one came to us from Kartemkin Films as part of their Voice for Voices and Documentary program, a great mentorship program that they offer for young filmmakers of color. And that was one of three films for Diverse Voices. They really stood out for their just great character development. And another one of those is a film by Bing Liu, now a well-known because of Minding the Gap, shortlisted for Academy Awards. What we did is we really gathered a collection of program directors from around the Midwest, from public TV stations, and went through the films and picked them for the diversity of the filmmakers, the films. It's really an eclectic mix. Some are films that have just been finished. Others, as you mentioned, Inquiring Nuns, 50 years old, but an amazing...
Yeah, you can hear that from the voices. Groovy.
I mean, it was a charming film. You know, watching that film is like opening a time capsule. It's just a fascinating look at Chicago in 1967. And the grainy black and white footage is riveting, and it has a film score by Philip Glass, which is amazing.
Wow.
And so it's really, the first season is a very eclectic mix of films, and I think that's what makes it so much fun.
We're talking about the Real Midwest series, which is airing on WILL and WTUEP and will run on other public television stations later this spring. Moss Bresnahan is here with us. He's the president and CEO of Illinois Public Media. And I wanted to welcome two of the filmmakers who are also participating in Real Midwest. David Rocchio is one of the producers of The Gun Shop. He's on the line from Vermont. Alan Parsa is a Chicago documentarian by the way of the Behind the Way to Andina. David, Arlen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you. Hey, Nyla. Thanks for having us.
David, let's start with you. The gun shop that's set for the setting for your film is actually in Battle Creek, Michigan. It's called Freedom Firearms. What was the goal with setting up your cameras in one particular gun shop?
Well, this show came from an idea I had. I live in Vermont. I feel bad because I'm not... a Midwesterner, but I'm really happy to be...
We'll give you honorary status, David.
Thanks very much. Vermont is as Midwestern as you can get this side of the Mississippi. So my vision was to create a documentary about a gun shop around here just to show the humanity of the people in the shop and let the story of guns tell itself. And then for circuitous reasons, I ended up talking to James Rogan, who took the lead on the project. He's a British documentarian, and he pitched me on the idea of selling it to Channel 4 because he thought it would be fascinating for UK audiences to look through the window into an American gun shop. And I love the idea of having a British team involved because they don't come to it with any biases. And then Channel 4 pushed us really hard to go urban, and we told them we wanted to be in a market that had cross sections of people, and it was not geared towards any one side of the discussion. And so we settled on the Midwest, and we worked really hard to find a shop that trusted us. And Joel at Freedom Firearms fit the bill. The director of the documentary is named John Douglas. He's a British filmmaker and is a master of fixed rig cameras. So we set up in the gun shop for 12 days and filmed everything. And it was a pretty interesting experience.
Let's play. We've got a little clip of it. Let's take a listen.
A gun is a machine. It is a machine that's efficient at doing its job, which unfortunately makes these mass shootings and whatnot more capable. But it is still a machine. The most unhelpful argument out there is take away all the guns, because that instantly makes the other side, and even the moderates who own weapons, it makes them just locked down. We have to accept that we have a problem and come together and work on a solution together without all the hate and rhetoric.
David, what can you tell us about that particular figure in the film?
Well, I don't want to get into the narrative arc of the story, because I think that's something that people will discover when they watch it. But it was really profound for us. So what we did, we set up in the gun shop, and we agreed we could film everything. We had to get releases, obviously. And then any stories we wanted to follow that came up in the shop, we could follow. And so this is a story that developed from a conversation within the gun shop. So it describes something that happened in the community. My vision for the show is to create real dialogue about guns in America. And the way you do that in the first instance is by listening. So it really is just a window on the culture of the shop. And the man who you just heard speaking, he was very articulate in a very difficult circumstance. And I didn't know what he would say when he was asked about what should be done about guns given the circumstances he was in. And I thought it was a really thoughtful answer, and it fits with our thesis that as we make a film about all the different interest groups on the issues of guns, we'll find more common ground than people think, and it'll be interesting to see if there really is an us and them on this issue as opposed to just us.
That's David Rocchio. He's one of the producers of The Gun Shop. He's the founder of Stowe Story Labs. And The Gun Shop is part of this Real Midwest film series that we have been talking about. Arlen Parsa is another on a complete, a very different topic. His film is called The Way to Andina. Arlen, so this focuses on the Colombian composer Eustacio Rosales, who just happens to be your great-grandfather. And before you tell us a little bit about it, I just wanted to play a little clip of this because to give us the audience a sense of the journey that they go on as you learn about your family's rich musical history.
When I think opera, I think like, ugh. Opera music feels like some kind of dinosaur that forgot to go extinct. It's not my favorite.
Should you be trying to resurrect this thing that maybe belongs dead?
What if we go to all this trouble, you know, hire a bunch of musicians and stuff and get a theater, and then it turns out that this music sucks? Maybe that's why it was never performed. We have no idea.
Arlen, how did this process begin for you?
Well, it was a wild adventure. Basically, my aunt called me up on the phone and she said, listen, I have something in my basement that I've been meaning to show you. And I went over to her place and we found these boxes in her basement, and they were chock full of this antique handwritten sheet music. You know, it's funny, Moss talks about Inquiring Nuns being this time capsule from Chicago 50 years ago. This was a time capsule from Chicago 100 years ago. We had all this antique handwritten sheet music written by Eustacio Rosales, who is my great-grandfather. He was a groundbreaking Hispanic composer here in Chicago, and he wrote all this music, and he started getting some fame and acclaim, and then all of a sudden he died one day, and it was sort of in the middle of the Great Depression, and his music went in a box, and it stayed in that box for almost 100 years. And so for me as a young person, seeing this music and not knowing the first thing about classical music or opera, I wanted to solve that mystery and figure out what did this music sound like and kind of fill in this gaping hole in my family tree.
And this also won Best Documentary at the Chicago Latino Film Festival. I wonder what you think this story tells us also. It's another Midwestern story.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. This is absolutely a Midwestern story, but it has its roots down in Colombia because my great-grandfather, Eustacio, he was an immigrant. He came from Bogota, Colombia in the early 20th century. And so part of, you know, his music-making career in the United States, in Chicago and other parts of the Midwest, was blending different types of music. He had kind of his own influences from back home down south, but he sort of melded these with other influences that he came across in Chicago. And the opera that we end up performing in the film, his long-lost work,
it kind of has these different influences, and it's really interesting and fun to listen to.
How did it change the way you think about your family, Arlen?
For me, it was a really emotional experience because this is a person who I never met, right? He died 80 years before we started this project. And so it was kind of like reconnecting with your past in a way and understanding a little bit more about kind of where you come from, where I came from, and understanding more about, you know, the world that I live in. I think for me, it's so important to be able to, you know, connect with that past. When we think about today and we think about people arguing over immigration and things like that, for a lot of Americans, immigration, although we might be descended from someone who came here from somewhere else, it's kind of this detached thing. And so to be able to actually put hands on something that he wrote, you know, this ink on the page, it kind of made me connect with that in a way that was new and fresh.
That's Arlen Parsa, who's based in Chicago, and we've been talking about The Way to Andina. David Ruckio has been with us as well. He's one of the producers of The Gun Shop. This is all part of the Real Midwest independent film series. David, Arlen, I wanted to just ask both of you guys about what it's like to be producing films and working in this industry and not be in New York or L.A. Arlen, you're in Chicago. David, you're based in Vermont, although this film that we've been talking about is set in Michigan. Do you think that there are advantages to not being on the coasts?
Well, I'll go first and say no. I think it's much harder to be distal, but I think it's much more interesting to find work that maybe you don't get pushed into doing because of what the market's dictating. And our experience with this show has been really interesting because it's sold very, very well overseas, but it's taken a long time to find someone willing to take it on in the U.S. because it doesn't take a typical approach to the issue of guns in America.
Right, because it's a really nuanced, it's sort of, I think, something that people on both sides of the issue will both find. It doesn't take a specific position. Arlen, what about you and being a Chicago-based filmmaker?
Chicago, obviously, it's a little bit of a smaller community than the filmmaking communities in, you know, on the coast, New York and L.A. But there can be some advantages to that. I think some of the costs, production costs, may be a little bit lower. And the community is a little bit more tight-knit. You know more people. But I'll tell you the truth. You know, David and I both work in nonfiction and documentary, and we know that there's stories to be told all over the country, all over the world. And I think geography doesn't need to be a restricting factor in the same way that maybe it was many years ago.
This is really one of the goals of a program like Real Midwest, too, to bring together the film community in the region and to try and support it and to encourage filmmaking and young filmmakers.
And that's Moss Bresnahan, who is with Illinois Public Media, the CEO who's launched this independent film series, Real Midwest, along with Kartemquin Films in Chicago. Moss, what are you hoping viewers take away from this?
Well, I think Real Midwest fits right in with the tradition of public media and our origins and our mission. I mean, we have the national series like POV and Independent Lens. I think Real Midwest complements those series really well. And, you know, I love the fact that it's bringing to air films that people otherwise might not have seen. Winners of film festivals and awards and recognition around the world. But, you know, the ability to bring it to local audiences is something that I think is really important and at the heart of what we do at Illinois Public Media.
That's Moss Bresnahan, CEO of Illinois Public Media. I want to thank David Ruckio, founder of Stowe Story Labs and a producer behind The Gun Shop. Alan Parsa is based in Chicago. His film is The Way to Andina. All of these are on Real Midwest, this film series we've been talking about. We'll have more information about this at our website at 21stshow.org if you're interested in these films. They will be premiering if you're in Peoria or Champaign on WTVP and WILL. If the rest of the state, they will be distributed to public television stations throughout the Midwest soon. Guys, all of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks
so much. Very
much. We'll be right back.
listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last summer, twin telescopes in Hawaii captured a bright anomaly 200 million light years away. It was there, and then it was gone just as quickly. And it turns out that moment might have been a star becoming a black hole. That comes after other news last month of new gravitational wave detections that help shed light on entire populations of black holes. I'm joined now by Shane Larson and Chris Pankow, two astrophysicists at Northwestern University who are studying this, and they're with us now from our studios in Evanston at the Medill School of Journalism. Both of you, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much.
Shane, it's been a while since you have been on the program talking about black holes, so we should probably get this out of the way first. And can you remind everybody what exactly is a black hole?
So black holes come in many flavors in the universe, but the kind of conventional thing that all of us know about is black holes are one kind of skeleton that forms when stars die. You take all the matter that was in the core of a star, something about the mass of our entire solar system, or 5 or 10 times the mass of everything in our solar system, and you squeeze it down to something like the size of a city. And when you do that, the gravity becomes so strong that not even light can escape, which, as you can imagine, makes it very difficult for astronomers to study with things like telescopes.
And so last week, your colleagues at the American Astronomical Society got together to talk about this really exciting phenomenon that I just mentioned. And actually, there you guys have a name for this, the birth of the cow, or more accurately, I should say, the black hole AT2018COW. First of all, where do these names come from?
So there are standard ways that we name all of these objects, and the conventions for each type of object I don't recall necessarily, but they often go with, you know, some indicator of the telescope that discovered it, some indicator of the year or the time that it happened, and then just a series of increasing indicators of which one was it we discovered. So COW is the kind of increasing indicator part of that. And as you can imagine, remembering that name is really hard. So we just shorten it to COW. And that makes it really easy to talk about and for everyone to know what we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah. So Chris, Shane, which one of you guys want to tell us about what you guys talked about with the COW last week?
Oh, yeah. So I think the really interesting part about all of this was that so astronomers and the measurements they've been making kind of pinned it down to two possible scenarios. And one of them is one of the processes that Shane just talked about, a supernova, which then collapsed a dying, very massive star into a black hole or possibly a neutron star. And then the thing that people are trying to figure out there is how or what the interesting interaction of all of this matter that gets thrown off from the supernova was with the medium around that that dying star. So that's one possible theory. And another one is that another type of compact object called a white dwarf, which is something similar to what our sun might turn into at some point, or maybe a little bit more massive than that. But this came too close to what we call an intermediate mass black hole, another member of the zoo of black holes we have, where Shane was talking about solar mass black holes, so 10 or 15 times the mass of the sun. This is something like 100 or 1,000 times the mass of the sun. And the white dwarf zoomed by the intermediate mass black hole, and because of the tidal forces, so the ability of the black hole to stretch out the white dwarf, it was basically ripped apart, and then all of that matter was accelerated and heated and could have produced a very bright flash similar to the supernova. So those are kind of the two theories that astronomers are working with for this event.
And so every time a star dies, does that automatically mean a black hole is born, Shane?
No. So this is why events like this are so interesting to us, is that as astronomers, we really want to understand all the different ways that stars die. And it's only the biggest stars, when they die, that they become black holes. And then kind of little bit lighter weight stars, when they die, they'll make supernovas, but they'll become this other kind of stellar skeleton, which we've talked about before, called a neutron star. And then the third way that stars die is what Chris just mentioned, the so-called white dwarfs. And that's reserved for the lightest stars in the universe, of which our sun is an example.
And so, Shane, it sounds to me, as someone who is not an astrophysicist or an astronomer, that black hole is kind of a more generic term for a class of an event than an actual one thing, right?
Yeah. Black holes come in many different sizes, as Chris alluded to. We have these stellar mass ones that result from stellar death. We have these intermediate mass ones that we think should exist, that we would really, you know, like to exist because it makes sense that they exist, but we've never seen one, so we don't really know if they do. And then there are what we call massive or supermassive black holes, and those live at the centers of galaxies. And there is one at the center of our galaxy, and there's one at the centers of many other galaxies as well. And those are millions and sometimes billions of times the mass of the sun, and where they come from is also a great mystery.
So, Chris, this stellar death that Shane was just referring to, is that what you guys, or that was what was observed in these telescopes last summer, perhaps?
Yes, it is. It's a very distinct possibility. So it leads back to one of the primary theories. So the supernova is the type of thing that takes you from having the dying star that we can still see, and then it goes undergoes a supernova, and it throws off a bunch of its outer layers, but the very, very dense core that's left over isn't able to support itself against gravity anymore, and it could collapse into a black hole. So one of the ways that people reveal the what they call the central engine in the supernova is to do the types of measurements of the spectrum of the light that's coming from these and correlate that back to how we know the supernova works or we don't know the supernova works. So that's one of the things that's pretty exciting about this particular sort of peculiar event.
So we're speaking to Shane Larson, who teaches physics at Northwestern University, and Chris Pankow, who's a postdoc fellow at Northwestern's University and works with the LIGO Scientific Collaboration Research Group. Chris, can you remind us what LIGO is, how many different scientists are studying this and working together to help improve our understanding of these things?
Sure. So we have a collaboration of well over 1,000 people over about 100 or so institutions really around the world. And they together operate, we're pushing towards a fourth right now, but we have three operating what we call interferometers. And these are mile-long Ls, I guess I would call them, that basically we use lasers to hear black holes. And the basic idea is that we shoot a laser down the interferometers, both arms of the L, and when it comes back, it should be in a very particular state, and we combine that into that state. And if we find that it's not in that state, in other words, that it doesn't add together in the right way, then we infer from that that a gravitational wave has passed by, thereby stretching one arm versus the other, changing the state of that light as it comes together at the center, and allowing us to measure things like gravitational waves.
Did you say you try to hear things, Shane? Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, so this is one of the difficulties that we gravitational wave astronomers have, which is how do you describe what we're doing? All of us are kind of used to describing the universe in terms of our senses. We see things, we hear things, we feel things with our sense of touch, or we smell things. But gravitational waves are a physical phenomena that your body is not designed to detect. As I like to tell people, you don't have a gravitational wave detector in your elbow. And so when we talk about what we're doing and what we're measuring, we are decidedly at a lack of words to describe what we're measuring. We can say measure and detect all we want, but it doesn't have that kind of same visceral feel that we as humans associate with describing things in terms of our senses. So you will hear us say see things in gravitational waves or hear things in gravitational waves, but that's not really what we're doing. We're detecting gravitational waves using lasers and these interferometers and these instruments that we've built.
And so they don't actually make sounds that we could hear.
They don't make sounds, but we can transform the data into sounds so that you can better understand, experience, perceive, think about what our data is and what it represents in terms of what the universe is doing.
So I know that, so Chris, what does it sound like, or what, when you're, the kind of data that you're looking for, is there a particular sound you're going for?
So it's a very distinctive sound, and it's interesting because one of the reasons we say hear is because the frequencies of the gravitational wave are very similar to human hearing frequencies. So when we transform the data, particularly for binaries, it's a very, very distinct sound that we call a chirp, and it sounds like a whoop. So it starts at low frequency and then very quickly ascends to a high-pitched frequency and then just ends when the two objects merge.
I wonder, LIGO, I know, as well as a couple other observatories, are planning to do a third observation run early this year. Chris, what are you guys hoping to collect or data to observe this year?
So we now know, so we've detected binary black holes, we've detected binary neutron stars. There's a third class of event that mixes the two, a black hole and a neutron star. There's an outside chance that we could detect one of those during O3, though we're not the prospects there are not as good. We know we're going to see probably or hear tens of binary black holes, maybe a handful of binary neutron stars. And there's other more exotic phenomena. So gravitational wave detectors are sensitive to supernovas as well. We just can't hear them nearly as far away as telescopes can see them. That would be a very exciting event if it were to happen. And we think the telescopes would also see that because it would be within our galaxy. Also a rare event. And then there are a few other types of exotic sources, such as an isolated neutron star that has a slight deformity on it. And if that neutron star is rotating in a certain way, then we would detect sort of what we call monochromatic gravitational waves, which is just gravitational waves at a single frequency.
So we'll start up in April right now is the current plan. And the difference between what we've done before and what's going to happen in April is that every time we shut down and start up again, we go into the detectors, we kind of tune them up, we improve them a little bit. So we're going to be able to see much farther into the universe than we were in our previous observing runs. And so what you heard Chris say, we're going to see more of all of these objects and possibly more exotic ones, is purely a function of that ability to see farther than we have been able to see before.
And when you're seeing these things, Shane, you've been able to deduce from this that almost all of the black holes share kind of similar properties, especially when it comes to weight. Why is it important to know that?
So this is part of this attempt on our part as astronomers to understand how black holes form and how stars die. One of the unusual things that LIGO has uncovered is there are bigger black holes, heavier black holes, than we would have reasonably expected going into this game. And as astronomers, when we think about stellar life and stellar death, that's really important because it's part of the story of how stars lead their lives and how one generation of stars leads to the next stars and so on. From the perspective of me and you and those of us sitting around the kitchen table listening to this broadcast, you know, it's like, why do we need to know about the lives of the stars? You know, this is part of the journey to understand where you and I and all the stuff of us came from, and the lives of the stars is the beginning of that story. So it's all kind of intertied together, and catching that thread and kind of understanding how it's all linked is kind of one of those big brain-melting things that takes a long time to understand and come to grips with.
And
even
so,
for us.
Right. Well, so for those of us who are not you guys, it sounds like the news of all of this information, especially over the past month, is pretty exciting when it comes to black hole news.
Yeah, I'd say we're giddy. That's a good word. It's these times, you know, when you start in astronomy, when you're a student, you're just going to college, you decide, oh, I'm going to be an astronomer. You read about times like this when you talk about the history of astronomy. And, you know, it's kind of part of the folklore of the way our field came to be. And it's kind of something remarkable to live through it and be a part of it.
Shane, and has the federal government shutdown affected any of the science and the work that you guys are doing?
That is a big question. We will need a couple of hours to discuss.
Okay.
But let me say definitely yes. You know, it inhibits us because a large fraction of our community are government employees at NASA and the National Science Foundation. A large fraction of our community work at the national observatories. And in particular, many of our students and many of our postdocs, folks like Chris, who are paid through government fellowships to do this kind of science, they are adversely impacted because they're federal employees right now. So this is really causing a lot of constraint, both on the science we can do, but also a lot of kind of personal constraint, as is true for many federal employees, to our scientific colleagues.
Well, thanks for sharing all of that with us. That's Northwestern University Shane Larson and Chris Pankow. Guys, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. It was great being here.
That does it for us this week. Please be careful on the roads if you're traveling this holiday weekend. There's continuing storms, not just tomorrow, but another round of snow for Saturday, and that's expected to have behind it some really cold weather, so keep an eye on the forecast. And next week, we're going to be talking about how to beat the winter blues. We'd love to hear from you what you do to try to beat the winter blues. Email your suggestions to us at talk@21stshow.org. On Monday, we've got a special hour we hope celebrates and honors the life of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This week would have been his 90th birthday, so tune in Monday for that. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great weekend.